Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. Today, I'm joined by author and associate editor of The Bookseller, Kathy Rensenbrink. We'll be discussing three new novels, including two debuts, one from journalist Kirsty Logan and another by ex-documentary maker Renee Knight, plus Lisa Kaufman's latest book, Villa America. That's all to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Kathy. We'll begin with one of our debut novelists, Renee Knight, who's an ex-TV documentary maker. Her book is called Disclaimer, and it's about a woman called Catherine Ravenscroft who loses her own self-identity after she's completely absorbed into an enigmatic book. Kathy, Disclaimer has been hailed as the next Gone Girl, the extremely successful 2013 novel by Gillian Flynn. Do you think this is a fair comparison?
Definitely. It's a very good thriller. And it has lots of interesting other things to say as well about the world. It comes from the same publishers who've just done The Girl on the Train, which has also been very successful. And I think that the title Disclaimer comes from that bit when you open a novel, when you say that you learn that supposedly there is no relation between the, you know, there is nothing in real life that is seen in the pages of the novel. But and she realises as she's reading this book that it is actually about her. I think it's such a clever idea.
Now tell me, obviously with Gone Girl and with this, it smells of film rights from the off. Do you feel this has a kind of a cinematic future?
Oh, definitely, yeah. They are so good, these, aren't they? You can completely see it as a film. And she, the character Catherine, is really compelling because on the surface, this always works well, doesn't it, in books and films. On the surface, she has everything, but inside she is already quite troubled. And then as she reads this book, she realises that someone else knows the secret about her that she thought only she knew.
And this kind of trick, you know, we've seen it in lots of in various forms in, you know, Being John Malkovich, all sorts of things where people cross over between a real world and, you know, Sliding Doors, all these other kind of films and stories. Why is it used here? Why is she using this way of being absorbed into a book?
That's an interesting question. I think it works very well, doesn't it, for the reader or the watcher. I think it's always quite a compelling idea that blurs the reality. And also, I think most people are interested in creative people, so I always like it when I'm reading a book and part of the book is delivered via supposedly a film script or a novel. And then obviously most things that are created will have some semblance probably or some inspiration from real life. So this is playing on that really.
Now, the notion of the debut novel, this sounds like something that's come out, you know, with a big hit straight away. What is it about the writing that you feel is particularly appealing?
It's just very pacey, very fast, very well done. And like lots of good thrillers, it completely works as a thriller. You just want to turn the pages and find out what happens. But there's actually quite a lot in it that's a bit deeper to think about. There's quite a lot about women and how they perceive themselves. It's quite a lot about the creative process.
That notion of, you know, Gone Girl, Sliding Doors, this... There's something that is particularly good about telling the stories of women. Why is that? Do you think it's because women feel often that, you know, life, work forces them to have a public front and a real life, or that they hold secrets away from people because of the demands of contemporary life?
I think so many women I know, important, successful women who look to the outside world like they're great, actually do feel that they're suffering from some kind of variant of imposter syndrome. So I think a lot of these kind of novels are playing on people's worst fear about themselves. People feel that they might get found out.
Now, we said that she was a documentary maker before. Does that kind of reflect itself at all in the narrative? Do you feel that there's a kind of a forensic look at the detail or a way of storytelling that pulls you through in the same way a documentary maker would?
Well, the character is also a documentary maker, so that's quite interesting. And again, there's this tension between the character, you know, Catherine has made this documentary that's been extremely well received, but she doesn't feel, people keep telling her how honest it is, how authentic it is, and she doesn't really feel that she has been honest and authentic in her work. So definitely a play there on presenting the stories of other people, but are you keeping your own secrets hidden deep to yourself?
Well, Disclaimer is by Renee Knight, and it's out now in the UK and North America, and it's published by Doubleday and HarperCollins. Well, let's move on now to Lisa Klausman's new book, Villa America. This tells a fictionalized tale set in the home of Gerald and Sarah Murphy, who were famously friends with artistic greats such as Picasso, Hemingway, and Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Here's a couple who have been well documented by artists and writers in the past, perhaps most notoriously in Fitzgerald's Tender Is the Night. What approach does Klausman take to their story?
Well, she does fictionalise it quite a lot. So we get the whole setup with all the characters that are familiar to anybody who knows their biographies and who's read some of the other novels about this period. But then equally, she invents a whole stream. So there's another person that comes into the marriage. There are three people in the marriage. And that is an entirely fictional creation, not based on any kind of reality at all. And I think that's interesting. I quite enjoy novels like that, where they're sort of fundamentally based on truth as far as we know it, but then inject another big healthy helping of fiction.
And as these famous characters, you know, come across the pages, you know, the likes of the Fitzgeralds and Picasso, do they appear to the reader as quite fully fleshed real people? Has she had to do quite a lot of historical research around them as well?
I think it's very well researched, and that's always I think it's very challenging, this type of book, and I completely think she pulls it off, because on the one hand it needs to be well researched because people will read it who are experts and who will get cross, you know, that cocktail wasn't invented in 1926 or whatever, but equally, to work as novels, they have to, I think, feel they have to feel real, but that means that they have to work as fictional characters, not just as people that have been sort of written down from facts onto the page. So I think she does a really brilliant job of doing it. And I mean, I feel if it's well done, I could fairly endlessly read about Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. They are just so fascinating.
And you do feel it is well done. The people you met and the story that unfolds is one that engaged you?
Very much so. And I wondered whether, because I have read another couple recently, because from the same sort of era, and there's one called Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi Woods, which is very good. And again, that's Ernest Hemingway as seen by his fourth wife. So I love this author. I really enjoyed her first novel, Tiger in Red Weather. But I did wonder whether I would have exhausted my appetite for reading about people from this era. And the answer is no, not when it's well done. I feel like I'd have more.
Do you think, you know, you've set out some of the challenges for the author, but maybe not in this case, but do you feel that there's also an advantage that you look around and you've got a set of real characters? You don't have to do all of the hard work in setting them up. You've got these dependable characters. In a way, you're weaving in and out between their lives.
Possibly, though I think it's difficult to do precisely because there is that challenge, and I think it'd probably be quite easy for it to fall flat.
And the events that unfold, how much is fantasy, do you feel, and how much is actually, did you end the book feeling, you know, I guess when I look at something like, you know, the famous, celebrated in every place now, Wolf Hall, that people enjoyed that because, you know, it was, yes, you know, a slightly imagined tale of the Tudors. But at the end, it was so blurred for people in their minds that they felt that it was a purely historical novel. At the end of this, do you feel, actually, I know a lot more about the period, the people, the characters, or do you feel you have been in a slightly fantastical world?
I definitely felt it added to, you know, it fleshed out what I think I know about that period and those characters. But then I also felt, and I think this is good, very much like I had, that I'd read a novel, that I'd read an idea that someone had made up about what would happen if two people met each other and sort of fell in love in a time when you weren't supposed to.
And tell me what the title Villa America means.
It's their house. So it's the house at which Gerald and Sarah Murphy held court and where everybody came to see them. This is just this massive glittering array of all the important cultural people at the time.
And it was it's a kind of version of their ideal utopia. It was their kind of perfect world in a way.
Completely. And of course, for all of them, it all goes wrong. And I think there's always that brooding. Again, when you read about the Fitzgeralds and you read about them during the happy times, and you do have that sort of terrible foreshadowing knowledge that it doesn't end well for them.
Well, there's plenty of disillusionment, debauchery and sacrifice, self-yearning and luster, I'm promised, in this book. Well, Villa America is by Lisa Klausman, and it's out today, and it's published by Picador. Let's end with another debut, this time by journalist Kirsty Logan. This is The Grace Keepers, about a floating circus and two young women in search of a home in a world where the sea has flooded the earth. Perhaps you can explain what happens here.
Yes, this is beautiful. This is a sort of a magical dystopia, really. Though you never really, as a reader, get a marker as to where we are. You know, you don't know whether we're in the future or whether we're in some kind of parallel universe or almost possibly in the past. It's just very, very beautiful, a very gentle, a very relaxed, rather lyrical novel. It's about insiders and outsiders. So the world is largely covered with water. There's a great distinction between the people who live on the land and the people who have to make their lives on the water, known, I think, rather well as landlockers and damplings. So if you're a dampling and a force to the water, you're not as high status as the landlockers. And our character, North, lives with a travelling circus. So they sail around on their boat, the Excalibur, and they dock into communities of landlockers and hope that their show will be good enough for the landlockers to give them food and shelter for a while.
And apparently this book has its roots in Scottish myths and tales. How does that show itself?
There is that, but it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because when I first read that, I thought, like, oh, I don't know if I fancy Scottish myths and tales today. But luckily, I didn't let it put me off. I think it's probably an inspiration rather than a direct correlation. Though again, to be honest, I'm not sure I'd recognise a Scottish myth or tale if it could be that it's a very close retelling of something that I just don't know about. But I really enjoyed it from the point of view of it's a very well created alternative world, which again, I think that's often quite difficult to do because you want lots of sort of nice, interesting descriptions of how things are different. But then equally as a reader, you need the world created for you. You don't want to feel that the author is having to tell you what to think this world is. So I think that's very, very well done.
Now, when you hear the description, you imagine this is in some way an environmental tale, a tale of our times and what could happen to the seas. Mm-hmm. But in your description of it, that doesn't sound as though it's been a very heavily played card.
No, it didn't feel to me like a campaigning novel. And as I said, it almost felt like it could be set in a pre-time or a... there are lots of novels, say, for example, Station 11 by Emily Mandel, which is a brilliant novel I read recently. And you read that thinking we as a human race need to watch out because this is around the corner. The Bone Clocks as well by David Mitchell. I felt that the bit of he shows a bleak apocalyptic future. And again, reading that, you do feel he's telling us to be careful. But actually, I didn't feel like this in this book. I just felt it was a story about two people who are trying to make their way in this odd, peculiar world.
And tell me, that relationship between, again, because there is the hint of Noah's Ark in the travelling circus, maybe even a hint of, life of Pi in some sense, but their life at sea with these animals, with the circus, is that a richly told part of the story, do you feel?
Yes, very well, and it's very well done. And North, the girl, she has a bear. She has a travelling bear. That's her part of the circus. There's lots of fabulous stuff about the details of the acrobats and how they fly. And then, of course, there's a great intrigue on the boat because the captain's a woman who has aspirations and ambitions beyond the benefits of the wider crew. So there's all sorts of shenanigans going along in there. And then the other character, Callanish, lives on this island and it's her job to tend the bodies of the people who are buried at sea, which is a grace keeper is. A grace keeper is someone who lives in solitude with this idea that their role is to honour the dead.
Now, Cassie Logan's been a poet and she's been a writing mentor and she is a writer. But do you feel that this is still an extraordinary feat? I'm always impressed, actually, when people just do a novel anyway, and a debut novel, but something as rich and as interwoven as this. You're an author, you're a critic. Do you still get amazed? I guess it's like the restaurant critic going to a restaurant for the first time, seeing a new startup and realising it's already turning out amazing dishes. What's your human response when you crack open these books? Are you sometimes a little bit dumbfounded that people have so much rich imagination to get out on the page in the first go?
That's such an interesting question. I think I always have my fingers crossed for everyone. Whenever I start reading a book, I want it to be good. I don't write hatchet jobs. I feel of myself as a recommender rather than a critic, talent spotter. I want, every time I open something, I feel very impressed that the person has managed to put all these words in on the pages in something like the right order. And I have my fingers really heavily crossed for them that it's going to work out. And of course it doesn't always, but certainly with The Grace Keepers, I think it's very accomplished. I hope this book does very well. And it also does give me an appetite to read what she writes in the future, because I've read quite a lot of her short stories and she just has a powerful imagination.
And when you look at all these three books, obviously these are all three books you love in different ways. Is there one of these that you would say would sit at the top of the pile by your bed?
That's very difficult because they're doing such different things. But I mean, I think the other thing actually I would like to mention about The Grace Keepers, the books are all well published, but the publishers of The Grace Keepers have done such a beautiful job on the physical object of the book. So it's all sort of, it's embossed, beautifully designed. There are wonderful end papers. So as a book nerd, in terms of just being in love with an object, I think that The Grace Keepers is something that even if you decided you didn't want to read it, you could sit and stroke it for quite a long time.
Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of today's show. Kathy Renson-Brink, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Tuck. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll be bringing you Karen Krasanovic to talk film. Until then, goodbye from me, and thank you very much for listening.